With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Here on Reality Check Radio, it's Real Talk with Rodney Hyde. Still can't quite get used to it. And we've got one of our most favourite guests that I've had on the show ever, and I think actually the most favourite. We've got Amy Brooke. Good morning, Amy.
Oh, good morning, Rodney. I see that flattery will get you everywhere.
Oh, good. No, I mean this genuinely. And it's a toss-up, and you'll be pleased to hear this. It's a toss-up between you and Professor Elizabeth Rata.
Oh, she's splendid. She's done wonderful work too.
And isn't it funny, these two ladies who speak their mind and who are very well schooled or very knowledgeable on the issues that confront us today and are prepared to speak out with such clarity, the two of you. I have to say it is wonderful.
Thank you, Rodney. So we're living in a very worrying time. I just thought nobody could now say that we are living in a free world and a free society.
Nope.
We're not. We're being systematically bullied on two major fronts, and it's very sad. And we've become a second world country rather than a first world country.
I read your absolutely wonderful book, The 100 Days Claiming Back New Zealand. Everyone should read this book. When I read it, Amy, I wept.
Oh, dear.
I wept for our great country, all that everyone has done, our forebears, to make it great, the sacrifice and hard work that they have done, and how it has been frittered away, and their legacy and their memory destroyed.
It's quite true. It's quite true. And the worst thing, really, I think about all this, is not only that the bullies are in control, but we've become an intimidated society. They've managed very, very well to prevent people speaking out, the hate speech legislation, the threats of, just various sorts of punishment. The accusations of racism or homophobia, there are two areas now where our country is being systematically attacked, really. And the 100 days I owe 100 days to a wonderful fighter pilot who came back and was aghast at what he'd seen. He was imprisoned in Burma and tortured to give away the location of the airfield from where he came. He was a New Zealander. And he was told in the end he'd be killed like a samurai, which wasn't much consolation to him. But he did survive, and he got back, and he was horrified then to see what was actually happening to the country. And he actually contacted me when I was writing for the Dominion and said, "Would you go and look at Switzerland?" He said, "This is what we need, and this is the whole point of the 100 days." But
I do want to talk about. I want to talk about everything, but it's going to take us weeks because your book,
it is
so wonderful. I want every listener to go and buy a copy, and we'll find out where they can buy a copy, because while it made me weep, Amy, you actually came up with an ingenious answer to all of it, as you say, from Switzerland. I was not aware until I read your book of this magnificent policy. I have been mulling it over ever since. It's genius, and it would work.
Yes, it would work, particularly in countries like New Zealand. And any reform really has to come from people, not from the government.
Absolutely.
It would work. The Swiss fought for it very, very hard, and it was opposed, especially in Switzerland at the time, probably about 170 years ago now. And I look at such good people in New Zealand who tried to do something about taking back the overweening power of politicians. In fact, I look at how so many of the recent at the damage caused by so many recent prime ministers, and I guess it adds insult to injury now to know that if they've been 2 terms, I think, and they retire from Parliament, we have to pay them up to £60,000 a year, plus all sorts of perks, to keep going, to sustain them after life after Parliament, after the damage.
Did they get a pension? I did not know that, because they killed off the pension scheme for MPs. So thankfully, I never get a dollar, which is as it should be. However, there is a travel entitlement depending on the years of service. And prime ministers, for some unknown reason, are forever entitled to a ministerial limo. But I didn't know. I'd have to check that with they're still getting paid. But what, again, I was amazed at with your book, this is sounding like I'm a fanboy, is the prime ministers of recent years all stand equally culpable.
Yes, they do. And the damage, the whole point about 100 days, we can talk, it would have stopped. I mean, John Key, undoubtedly, I'm happy to argue this caused enormous amount of damage to this country. With the anti-smacking legislation, was opposed by 75%. He took absolutely no notice of that. The foreshortened seabed bill, which was of which Chris Finlayson, who I also would argue has caused an awful lot of damage to this country, it was pushed through Parliament. It was pushed, and the damage it's caused because of various groups now. Finlayson assured us, of course, that only a very few happy we would be able to claim any percentage of the shoreline and seabed, and it doesn't just mean the sand; it means minerals and all sorts of things, and rights for trading and setting up infrastructures or anything, fishing boats, access, all sorts of things given to these groups who are then in control of this area of the coastline. Now, Finlayson, I think, would regard himself as a very clever lawyer, so he made a big mistake on this one. Or was it a mistake? This is the things we've got to ask ourselves. But if the 100 days had been...
I can tell you for sure the answer to that question. It was not a mistake. It was deliberate. And I know that because I worked with Chris Finlayson, and he was telling me what he was doing in a particular piece of legislation. And I discovered he was misleading me. And my officials confirmed it. And years later, I met one of his staffers who confirmed it. Well, I didn't find him very honourable. Being careful how I word it. And I think it's deliberate, these policies, because he ain't stupid.
Well,
so, and of course, he jumped from being a lawyer working for iwi to being a lawyer working back for iwi, as I understand it.
Yes. It's very tricky, really, because Chris, if he didn't intend the foreshortened seabed to be claimed, because a lawyer could, of course, drive a horse and cart through the provisions that were set up, and they've done just that. If he didn't, one would have to say it's subversive, and one would certainly hesitate to say that. But the Ngāi Tahu deal, of course, was at the time, was a third and final settlement, and Ngāi Tahu lied. They lied, consistently lied. Lindsay Perigo, at the time, published 3 booklets by Ellen Everton, and a lot of us had done independent research showing that Ngāi Tahu systematically lied through their teeth when they claimed that third and final settlement. I remember Mrs. Tirikatini Sullivan was very angry about what they claimed, too, because she knew a lot of the things were untrue. But Chris rejoiced that he'd beaten the Crown lawyers. He represented Ngāi Tahu. It wasn't such a great effort to beat the Crown lawyers because they admitted at the time that they were completely ignorant of the history. I think they said they had 2 lawyers that specialised, one in French and one in geography. And because they knew nothing of Ngāi Tahu's history, this is on record, they relied upon Ngāi Tahu to tell them the facts. Well, you know what the result would have been, and it was. And Ngāi Tahu have wield an enormous influence, and they're a very dangerous tribe. Down south in Otago, for example, my old university, which is completely going to the dogs, any application for funding from any department, whether it's in physics or chemistry or music or so on, has to be passed by Ngāi Tahu to decide who gets the funding. And I do know at Canterbury University, the local iwi approached when a new professorship was available because in the arts faculty, because of the resignation of the one who'd been serving us very, very well. He was an excellent man. He stood up to a lot of the impositions on cultural sensitivity that were imposed on students if they wanted to get a degree from Canterbury. This particular group promised if their candidate, who didn't even have a PhD at the stage, if she was appointed professor, they would pay half her salary. Now, I'll argue that all around the country now, that very, very wealthy groups are having a disproportionate amount of influence on the directions in which we are going.
That's why your book is so amazing, because it goes right across the political, social, cultural landscape of New Zealand, documenting the fall, and then comes up, and let's cover it now because there's a whole lot of things I want to ask you about. Tell us what the 100 days is for listeners.
Well, the real theme of the 100 days was what the Swiss contrived for themselves. And I look back with admiration at the people who tried to say, let's have some more say in government. And to get a BCIR, a binding referendum, well, it was supposed to be binding, it never was, they worked so hard to get over 300,000 signatures, which is ridiculous, of course. Now, the facultative referendum, which is what the Swiss got, is quite different. In Switzerland, they said, any legislation passed by Parliament, and this is the whole point, any legislation passed by Parliament has to sit for 100 days. If the people think that's okay, fine, then it goes through. If they say, well, hang on, we're not sure we like the way this is going, and they did this with regard to building more mosques in Switzerland, the Swiss government apparently at that stage felt a bit guilty about not joining the EU, and they said, oh, we will have to allow this. And the people said, well, no, we don't want this. If they call for referendums, they have 26,000, only 26,000 signatures. Oh, it's 50,000, I'm sorry. For New Zealand, it would be proportionately 26,000 based on our population comparisons. If 50,000 only, not 300,000, people say we want a referendum and call for it, it has to be mounted. And the people say yes, they say no. This was amazingly different. If we said, if I said to you, who's the president of Switzerland, for example, who is the president of Switzerland, Rodney?
I have no clue.
No, nobody has. And the reason is they're so very sensible. This president can stay there only for a year. We really shouldn't allow prime ministers to dig in, as Jacinda Ardern did, and look at the damage she caused. She still is causing a lot of damage, of course, behind the scenes with the Christchurch call. If they're now trying to, introduce, criticising the transgender movement, or saying it's transparently not the case. Sorry as we may feel, and sympathetic as we may feel to people who've decided they're transgender, you simply, of course, can't change sex. You are either male or female. J.K. Rowling's spoken about this very bravely. She risked imprisonment by saying so. This is what I mean by saying we are no longer a free society. It could be called hate speech, which is, of course, utterly,
the 100 days,
utterly absurd.
The 100 days would be amazing. And there's no good argument against it, because legislation would be passed by our parliament. This is how I would understand it. It would await the Governor General's signature to become law. It would have to wait for the mandatory period of 100 days. And as you say, if there was agitation against this legislation, you could get 26,000 signatures.
50,000. Oh, no, quite right. 20, no, 20 or 50,000 would be fine. We'd get those easily.
Yes, 50,000, 26,000, whatever, signatures, and a referendum has to be called. That would be a parliament that belonged to us, not them.
Absolutely. Well, not only do the Swiss swap places, guess how many are people, well, you probably know now you've read the book, the people in the Swiss cabinet, how many are there?
Oh, I can't recall. Sorry.
Seven.
Not seven.
There's seven people in cabinet, and usually the finance minister, the president steps down after a year, and the finance minister steps up and becomes president. That's the usual procedure. They manage it so well that parliamentarians aren't full-time parliamentarians. They're expected to hold jobs, to be nurses, doctors, lawyers, tradesmen. That's fine. They meet one day a week. But they're encouraged to stay out and work in the community as well to keep them in touch with the community. I think Parliament meets only four times a year. But the really good thing is that there's no tops-down legislation. That the legislation has to come from the communes and the cantons. If someone wants something, and this is where the BCIR referendum doesn't work so well, if someone in Switzerland decides that they want lots and lots more mosques in the country, then they will try and mount the other kind of referendum, and it doesn't go down well at all, it doesn't succeed. What does the Swiss say? No thanks, we're fairly conservative, we don't want this, we want to keep our country unified if at all possible. This is not, of course, saying anything against very good Muslim people, and there are extremely good Muslim people. But when you get the Islamification of a country, that's a different issue entirely. And this is what's caused such damage to France and England and the whole of Europe at the moment.
And the United States.
Oh, yes. Everywhere, really. We can be particularly naive in trying desperately not to actually discriminate against people. We've lost the ability to see that. Of course,
you have to discriminate, don't you? I mean, discrimination is being...
We're supposed to be taught to. But look, what's our schools now are an utter disgrace. I could give you a list of the things that the neo-Marxists within the Ministry of Education did to really deliberately destroy education, and I don't say this lightly, in this country, and that's another huge issue. And the so-called reforms are going to accomplish absolutely nothing. Because the schools now, of course, are teaching children what to think, not how to think. And we're not going to have genuine reforms. Six experts have been appointed to look at it. The experts are the problem. Their introductory spiels were all in Te Reo for a start, and that's another hugely problematic area. But anyway, legislation in Switzerland has to come from the people themselves, suggestions for legislation, communes and the cantons, and it gets presented to Parliament, and Parliament puts it back, of course, at 100 days. Here the deals are done behind the scenes and stitched up, as with Sue Bradford, Helen Clark, and John Key on the anti-smacking legislation. You know, it goes, you support me on this one, and I'll support you on that one.
Indeed.
And people are simply excluded. And all we can do is toss out various governments at election time when they've caused so much damage that it's going to be a huge issue for the next government, as it is with National now, trying to reverse some of this damage.
And, of course, they don't have the appetite or the support to reverse it.
Well, another thing is the government departments now, and civil servants and the media, of course, the media have become fifth columnists. They're attacking at the government, the thoroughly left-wing media, causing an awful lot of trouble. And that's why Luxon's attention has been focused on the economy. He's moving very slowly on areas where he needs to move a lot faster, and that is simply issuing an order to all the government departments to rename the institutions, as a couple of ministers have done, Simeon Brown, to his credit, and was it Louise Upton? I'm not sure. But to order them immediately to identify all the government departments in Māori. Now, I noticed this morning that the conservation minister has told DOC to keep using Te Reo Māori, everywhere and anywhere. And this contradicts the government's official position. He should be hauled into line.
Who was the Minister of Conservation that said that?
Tama Pataki.
My goodness.
I think he's national.
Anyway, he's done this.
And the media are doing this. And the media, of course, are piling on fake Māori. The whole thing about Te Reo, I would like to mention this, Rodney, if you don't mind. The point about Tereo, which is being inflicted, and what a shocking waste of time when there are so many other valuable subjects in school. Genuine Māori is a different thing. I remember my father years ago teaching in a native school, being very distressed to be told, because he was learning Māori, being very distressed to be told that the children weren't going to be allowed to speak it in the classrooms anymore. And he said to Sam Cotter, I think, head of the Aupuri group, Aupuri, I think I've got that quite right, at North, up at the North Island, Hawke's Bay. But he said, why? And he was told that a delegation of Māori, I pulled Willie Jackson up on this years ago when he talked about you strapping us all for using Māori in schools. It was a delegation of Māori elders who went to Parliament and asked for Māori to be outlawed in schools because they wanted the children to learn English with the same degree of proficiency and to have the same chances. So many lies have been told about our shared history that it's quite outrageous, really. But anyway, we are now being bullied. And Tereo, just let me say this, Rodney. Tereo now, the original Māori, this is important to say, the original Māori had about 1,900 words, not even 2,000. The most common English, and there are all sorts of obsolete words, has 170,000 words. You put a percentage of 2,000 into 170, and you'll say about 1.18% of Māori, of Te Reo, is actually genuine. But then they're coining the words. The words that are supposed to be for Land Revenue Department or, you know, flights overseas to Australia, all the equivalent Māori is made up. It's utterly fraudulent. Children could be learning. It's not recognised overseas, and children could be learning far more and should be, and the homeschooled children are. They're doing absolutely wonderful work.
I love the statistic of how many words are originally in Māori. And I had been searching for that and wondering about getting an early dictionary, because typically, as I understand it, an educated person's vocabulary is really only 2,000 odd words. And if you don't have a written language, you can't progress to having a large number of words. It's simply not possible. And do you know where that 1,900 word number comes from?
I did know originally. I remember writing on it for Investigate years ago, but it would take me a long, long time
yes,
to go back and check my sources.
It is exactly the mad insanity of people learning Te Reo, which, you know, I've got no problems with. But the idea that you're learning the language as it was spoken in 1740 is absurd.
It's not Maori. It's made up. It's a fake language, more so even than Esperanto. It's
yes.
a fake language. I can understand the Maori people wanting, and my father said at the time, but Sam, how will the children learn Maori? He said, oh, we'll talk about it. We'll talk it at home. We'll pass it on down. And they didn't. And we're now paying for Maori television and all sorts of ways. We're spending, what, $46 million a year, is it, on pushing Te Reo in Maori Language Week and so on, when it's not a language which is spoken anywhere else in the world and where we have a great need to learn and teach our children international languages so they can take... We're not even teaching them English properly. The hitchhikers from overseas who come to New Zealand, from France and Germany, places like that, they speak English far better than so many New Zealanders. It's a social crime, really, that we have cheated New Zealanders, not only today's children, but their parents, out of anything like the education that their parents... their own parents would have had.
What do you make of it when you get a letter from the from a school, or it's the ones from the school that get me because I get so many of them, and you get this letter, invariably rather poorly constructed letter, and peppered all the way through it is Māori words. And you and I both understand how the English language has evolved, that one of its great strengths is it takes on words from other languages that are useful. But this is so artificial and not useful because it becomes a huge barrier to communication and understanding. And it irritates me incredibly when we have such
a beautiful... You're not the only one. I should imagine it irritates the majority of New Zealanders.
And you know that if you wrote back and said, listen, either write to me in Maori or write to me in English. Don't do both, because it is painful to try and understand what it is you're trying to say and or who you're trying to impress. I mean, it's the artifice of it. It's the, here we go, you know, look at me. I'm using these Maori words.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It's quite true. It's embarrassing, but apart from that, it's rude. It's another case of virtue signalling, often by the person who's doing it, but it's part of cultural bullying.
Yes.
It certainly confuses whatever someone's trying to say. It's interesting, too, that Chris Bishop now is refusing to change his kanga ora, is it? He's refusing to change the name of his government department over to English. I mean, we're a country where people are openly, including ministers, defying the government, let alone the media with their virtue signalling. If someone writes to me now with Maori introductions, and I just say, please write, I'm not Maori, please write back to me in English. And actually, to tell the truth, Ronnie, as you know very well, most part Maori don't support this nonsense.
No.
It's creating dissent all over the country, and it's extremists only in two particular areas of our country at the moment, the social traffic, which are causing this divisiveness. And a country divided against itself simply doesn't stand. In the end, assimilation, rather than promoting so-called diversity, which has many drawbacks as it can help, we're a country really which is at loggerheads with itself. And it's very much the result of the people at the top and the people pushing their own agenda. And behind all this, it's called progressivism, but behind all this is neo-Marxism. Because when communists want to it sounds old-fashioned, but it's true, when communists want to destroy a country, they sow dissent right through it. The long march through the institutions.
It's exactly right. And, of course, they've got this wonderful position where they're so caring and so lovely, and you're dealing with now graduates of the university system who have no proper educational training or critical thinking skills, and they repeat ad nauseum this bilge. And if you say, well, you know, you've got a bad dose of neo-Marxism, or, you know, you've got critical theory, they just scoff at you because they're perfectly trained in it. So they know to denigrate you, and they know there's no such thing as truth, and that they are righteous, and that's how they approach it. It's such a clever operation that's occurred here in New Zealand and around the West, isn't it? It's unbelievably clever.
Well, it's diabolical. You could diabolical. Say if you want to get back to things. If you want to get back to things, basically, when someone said to me, he said to me he'd never believed in God, but he started to believe in God because he believes in evil. And that's something we have to look at. What is
that? Was me, that's me.
And what
that's
is exact, evil?
That's me. I am a firm believer in God. I am a Christian as of last year, because I looked that's around. Good. And I said, I can see the evil. And I can see everything that we... Here's another thing that affected me quite deeply. It's the coordination of the evil.
Yes, that's really interesting. It's quite true. Movements springing up. That's really interesting. It got worse and worse. We wondered what could possibly be worse. And then we got onto transgenderism.
That's
and
right.
Then we got onto pushing. Then we got onto pushing... sexual divisiveness we got onto confusing children sexually. Sex education, of course, if you've read the 100 Days book, which, by the way, you asked if it would be available on my website, I'm afraid at the stage. My website would, you know, www.amybrook.com.
Do the webpage now, because I tell you, the book is wonderful. There's no one listening that won't enjoy this book in terms of its prose and ideas. There's no one that won't profit from the insight and scope, and no one won't be there. No one will doubt that what Amy is proposing, following the Swiss, this 100-day rule, that there is a solution that we can support. So please, where do we go for the book?
Oh, to my website, and it's just the usual www.amybrock.co.nz.
And book with an E.
Yes. Brock, yes, Amy Brock with an E.
Sex education, nice, I can tell you about the sex education, because I'm having this debate now with the school. And I'm feeling like writing off to the teacher and saying, "Dear Mr. So-and-so, I'm my daughter's father, and I see that you're down to teaching my daughter about anal sex. I wonder if we should meet. She's 13.
Goodness. Well done.
I haven't sent that letter yet. But a complete stranger is going to be teaching a 13-year-old girl and her classes about anal sex. What's even more upsetting about it is, in the email where they said, we're going to be having this health thing, and I asked for the curriculum, I still haven't got it. I managed to get it through a third party. It is absolutely horrifying. If anyone did it outside of school, they'd be in jail. And they implied that it was compulsory. Well, they said it was compulsory.
It's not.
They also said, and I haven't yet got the resources from the school. Now, this is just an average little school, right? And so, by the way, anyone listening, I discovered through Let Kids Be Kids, and that you can apply under Section 51. I write to the principal and I say, my daughter won't be attending this course, thank you very much, and she will be supervised elsewhere. Now, how many parents know that? How many parents know what these videos? Do you know who's heading up these videos teaching my daughter about this stuff? Guy Williams, the comedian.
Oh, really?
It's all a big Goodness. Joke to them. They've got these young boys saying, oh, yeah, and you stick a condom on, and, you know, we call them a rubber or a Johnny. This is to 13-year-old girls. Oh, sure.
Dear Rodney, 20 years ago at Nelson College here, the boys were being, and one of the career schools, the boys were fitting condoms onto bananas. They had handed around bananas. It's absolutely, it is a great evil, I think. Because
it is an evil, and that's our point, isn't it? That's our point. This evil is right through. Yes. And you meet these teachers, they're lovely people, but they don't realize that. So, like, they're brainwashed or in a cult. And of course, they think that you and I are old dinosaurs.
Many good teachers know, and many good teachers try and mitigate what's happening. And of course, many, many good teachers have left the profession because they simply can't stand what was happening. But even long years ago, when I was teaching at Queen's High School in Dunedin, when a doctor was brought in once a week to teach the girls sex education, they hated it. And I remember when I just said, no, my children won't be attending sex education classes, I went to the schools, of course, said, no, that's not happening. I was told these children would feel, my sons would feel so embarrassed. They bully parents, so embarrassed by being pulled out of the classroom. They weren't. I remember also when I taught at Nayland locally, I was teaching Latin for a while, and they had a choice of a couple of parents asked, and I got my son through school certificate very early in Latin. They asked if they could do Latin instead of life skills, and the headmaster, who was actually very good value, which is more than a lot of heads are. A lot of them really are not much at all, as you will have discovered. But anyway, he was very good value, and he said these boys want to learn Latin, they can learn. The life skills teacher, who incorporated sex education into her classes, was absolutely furious. She threw a big wobbly, and the headmaster was scared of her. So the others were stopped. Two had been given permission, but the others weren't allowed to. And they were so grateful. The children don't like it. And the other thing is that children who get a crush, as is quite natural, your 13 or 14-year-old, boys get a crush on the captain of the, you know, first 11 or rugby team, and the girls get a crush. They just get crushes, and they go past that. But nowadays, they're recruited. Oh, do you see that Mary is looking very, very fondly with Betty? They're getting on so well. I think they might be lesbian. And they start to recruit. And this is part what really annoys me about gay pride movement in schools. This whole movement really has its motto of really empowering. Why? Why should they be empowering? Parents who object into drag queens in libraries and now are being accused of being homophobic. They're not. What are the drag queens doing in libraries? They're not there out of the kindness of their heart. They're basically recruiting. Mark Alexander, you may remember, he was a very good MP.
He was a very good MP, actually, I remember him well.
He was a good bloke. He was going to introduce on a private members bill, he was going to introduce the 100 days that he got into Parliament. He stood again for National, and National didn't want him. They really want, just like Chris Finlayson. Chris Finlayson was never even voted into Parliament. He was a Listed MP. So no, New Zealanders didn't vote him into Parliament, but he became a Listed MP. He became a Minister of Treaty Negotiations, and many would argue that because of Chris, we've inherited an awful lot of trouble in this country. And he wanted co-governance recently. He was calling people nutters and offensive names if they don't agree with his stance. He's done this quite often. But anyway, parents were told their children would be too embarrassed. And parents, I remember speaking to a local parent about this and encouraging. She said, well, the thing is, what do I know? She said, I don't know. New Zealand parents aren't strong enough. And as with the Ministry of Education, until we take control of the curriculum out of the hands of the ministry with their agenda and back into the hands of parents, we're not going to do anywhere. But that's probably something that's going to have to wait for another interview.
Yes, indeed. It's astonishing. I discussed it with my daughter. She doesn't want to go near it. And I said, I'm happy to show you all the videos, but I will sit with you. She said, I don't want to see them. I said, how would you feel about sitting through these videos? I described them not very graphically.
Good.
And she said, no.
And, some are shocked. I've been rung by mothers who didn't realise the sex education class was that day. And they said, one mother said, my daughter was absolutely shocked. We're shocking
shocked.
Children.
It shocked me. It shocked my wife. It didn't shock us.
We need a rebellion, Rodney.
We really need people.
I remember what Dante said. Do you remember Dante? The hottest places in hell are reserved for those who see a great evil and do nothing about it. There are so many really good New Zealanders fighting very hard.
I did not know that phrase. Say that again. That is so powerful.
I might be paraphrasing it, but it's more or less that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who see a great evil and do nothing to replace it. Now, I remember also down in Kurai years ago when sex education comics got put out, and we called a local meeting of the local traffic cop, who was very good, and some farmers and so on, and we wrote away and objected to the values that were being pushed in these comics for children. And they wrote back and said we had no right to impose our own values on them. We said this stuff is insidious and it's nasty and it shouldn't be there. And they said you're just trying to impose your own values on these children. You've got no right to. And some people will back up and say, oh, really? But they were imposing theirs. It's very cunning. The damage being done to children in this country is appalling. We have shocked them through the whole nonsense of the CO2 causing climate catastrophizing, which is completely untrue. We're still stuff. I'm beginning to wonder, money counts, you know, Rodney, apart from that phrase I always remember. I can't actually remember that one at the moment, but I know, money counts, I'll not deny. I saw it once, it said goodbye. I always feel like that. But I begin to wonder how much stuff and the Herald are paid to deliberately withhold any articles by top New Zealand and other scientists saying that the whole CO2 global warming business is a scam. We have climate change. We've always had climate change, but it's not caused by CO2, which nobody's ever proven, and which, as Ian Plimer says in Australia and elsewhere, has always followed climate change. It's always followed warming. CO2 doesn't cause. And of course, that we've of course got terrified children now thinking the world's coming to an end and they're out on the streets marching. If we're not doing that to them, the teachers are pushing them into this, of course, the agenda-ridden teachers. And if we're not doing that to them, we're telling them that they could be transgender and they can pick whatever sex they like. And one boy in some schools pretending he's decided he's a dog now and he has to have a bowl of water and he barks when people come near him. What in God's name have we done to children?
The indulgence of children is extraordinary.
That too.
One of
the propagandizing was worse.
Yes. One of the parts of your book that I truly loved and I whooped for joy was your analysis, philosophy, view of modern art.
Oh, don't get me onto modern art. What a switch.
I've got to get you onto modern art because you are the little girl who's saying, but that emperor's got no clothes.
I hope it was a little girl. It might have been a little boy.
Might have been.
If it was very smart.
But tell us your view on modern art.
Well, it would depend on the modern art, wouldn't it? I mean, there are still very fine artists like Graham Taylor, who's over in Marlborough, who's doing beautiful work. But basically, again, it's a captured situation. Colin McCann was fated as one of New Zealand's most important painters. Well, he bullied his eldest boy so much they took him out of his care because they thought he would kill him. He was an alcoholic, and some of the alcoholics ran galleries, and they looked after themselves very, very well. Colin McCann, I used to call Colin McCann. If you're going to claim to be a great artist, you can certainly claim...
Sorry.
You can certainly claim... You can claim to experiment. It's perfectly reasonable. But to claim to be an artist, you must be... a genuine artist, you must be able to be competent in the tools of your trade. And if you can't paint, if you actually can't produce anything which is recognisably realistic, as a portrait or a landscape or anything, then don't claim to be a great artist, just claim to be an experimentalist. It's fraudulent, most of it, that the paintings, people who say this is great art, I just say, well, prove it. You have to see... you have to be able to look at it and say, yes, undoubtedly, this has been created by someone with enormous skills and they're well in control of their media. If they're not, then... If this got pushed by a couple of New Zealanders who made a fortune out of... Actually, I won't name them here at the moment, but you may know them, but in fact, I'm sure you do. But they were grabbing up artists who were pretty useless and promoting them as the great artists of the future, and they made an awful lot of money out of doing this.
It's... do you think... they're all in on it, like they know it's a joke. Like it's a joke. This art is a joke.
I don't know. It's strange, isn't it? And people are enormously... Karl Popper said this, people tend to take so much of what's told them. Like children, I remember years ago seeing things as a child. You just observe them, you just watch them, you don't analyse. Very few people actually analyse things. I remember years ago at the Summer Sound Symposium where you came, and we used to have it was great because we used to get people right across the spectrum from left or right. It was fun, wasn't it? And we said no blood on the floor, but whether it's Chris Drosser on the left or Roger Coe on the right or someone, we used to argue the issues of the day in the hope that we could clarify what positions actually should be. And now, what were you talking about? Because I've actually lost the thread.
We were talking about whether these artists realise that they know that they're taking the mickey out of us. And
some artists do, some are deluded. Toss Williston really couldn't paint at all, but he thought he was wonderful. Toss Williston really was an old fool. He thought he was wonderful, and he wasn't. He can't paint. He couldn't paint, but he was deluded. But I know why I was talking about analysing, because, we'll just revert back for a minute, Rodney, but at the Summer Sounds, I remember someone who did end up as an MP, standing up after we were given an extremely good talk by Gerrit van der Lingen on the whole fraudulent CO2 causing climate catastrophizing. And he stood up at the end, this man who was an MP and was a prominent Wellington lawyer. He stood up and said more or less, oh, shucks, He said, "No, I don't know what to believe." He said, "I hear a very good lecture from you, Garrett, that saying it's all a scam, a hoax, which it is." And that was a lot of money behind that one, too. He said, and then I listened to someone saying, "No, no, it's real." And he said, "I don't know what to believe." This is interesting. He's a lawyer. "I don't know what to believe," he said, "so I'll just follow the party line." And that's what, of course, people like Christopher Luxon want. They want people to follow the party line when the party takes a line. And Luxon, who I have to say is not the sharpest tool in the box, Luxon also believes in the whole global warming scam, CO2 driving it. I think he even thought that CO2 caused Cyclone Gabrielle. I think he's on record somewhere saying that. And that's the trouble, letting politicians make the decisions. And many of them are the products of a failed education system that went rapidly downhill in New Zealand from the 1960s onwards. And that's why sometime I hope we will get time, not now, because there's so much to it, and looking at what happened in education, why it happened, why they deliberately got rid of external examinations, and what the result has been. But we'll move on. But this, what struck me, this bloke said, "Oh, shucks," he said, "I don't know what to believe, so I'll follow the party line." So a great, the idea was always, and this is what Stuff should be doing and the Herald should be doing, if they really believe that CO2 causes global warming, they're on very safe ground to allow some of the first-class scientists we've had in this country and elsewhere come on board and say, "No, well, actually, it's wrong." They don't dare to do it. And that's why I'm thinking, follow the money. What's pushing this? Are the media being bribed? I don't know. It sounds like a far-fetched accusation. But why are they so utterly determined never to allow anyone at all to actually to dispute the whole basic hoax? Because that's what it is. There's an awful lot of people waking up. And the Australian Spectator's been running some very good articles on this.
You wrote wonderful columns for the Dominion Post for many, many years, which everyone enjoyed, and they were a must read. That was back in the days when
teachers didn't. I got into lots of trouble with teachers.
But even if you disagreed with you, people would still feel the need to read you, and because that was back when we read newspapers. But you were allowed to publish. You can't imagine that now, can you?
Yes, columnists was allowed a point of view. It wasn't. You didn't have to follow the party line. You could, as long as you could substantiate it. Gosh, the cancelling started early. I remember going down when I was down at Otago University. I'd first of all done because I didn't sit scholarship. The nuns in many ways were absolutely marvellous at school, but they didn't teach chemistry and high maths, so I wasn't able to sit scholarship. And typically I felt guilty about this, and my father wasn't giving me at all pleased. And so I thought I'd better placate him. And I therefore took Latin 1 and English 1 extramurally from Canterbury University. And I said, "Why extramurally?" I said, I live in Timaru, but I didn't say I'm at boarding school. So when I got down to Otago, you had to go and see the professor in whose area you're probably going to major. I did major in Latin and Greek, and English. And at the time I went to see the professor. And he was furious that I'd already done stage 1 from Canterbury University. He was horrible. He remained horrible ever since. And he would always mark my essays very low. So in the end, I'd hand them over to a friend who'd hand them over to someone else. I remember one teacher of Old English, who was a dear old man. I handed my essay over to someone, and he got an A. And this particular professor that I had to deal with always gave me Cs. And he was supposed to specialise in Charles Dickens. And he was supposed to be one of the world's authorities in Dickens. And he gave us a lecture one day. And I thought, that's a bit odd. He's missed something here. And you're allowed, of course, you're supposed to be allowed, of course, in university days, not now, to say anything as long as you could substantiate it. So I found this line of thinking interesting, and I substantiated it, and I handed it in to the professor. He was gravely displeased. He said, "Very interesting, Miss Mora, but not what we wanted." Isn't that interesting? He cancelled a friend of mine, too, who was also a very, very bright bloke, doing Latin, because he found out he was writing a long poem called Marching Across Thrace. If he hears me, he'll know who I'm talking about. And he said, "Right, I'm going to make sure this professor said, I'm going to make sure he doesn't get a first-class honours degree." Lovely, isn't it?
Lovely. Lovely. That guy Pollock, what was his name? Jackson Pollock. You remember that American artist yep. that, yeah, I think he died
in the
1950s. That was just nuts, right?
Sorry, I missed you then, Rodney. What was that?
That's just nuts, right? His artwork splashing paint on a canvas, and everyone goes, oh, it's so wonderful.
No analysis there. They're told what to think. Some expert says it's wonderful, they all think, or therefore it's wonderful. I don't know much about art, but it must be wonderful. That's what they will think.
I didn't follow it up, but I saw a link on Twitter, and there's this guy called Mike Bentz, and I haven't made a study of him. I keep meaning to. And he's supposedly ex-CIA or something, and he's very persuasive and very well-spoken. And he's got a view that the intelligence services were big on funding artists in the Cold War to promote American art, and that they could literally manipulate the art market. I've been thinking about this a lot. I don't know if this is true or not, but it's just a funny thing. Because you can imagine.
I missed that. Who was manipulating it?
Oh, the intelligence services like the CIA. To prove that America could produce, to prove that America could produce art, because they had no art. Apparently, this is his theory, his analysis, his experience. And I've often thought about that since, and it'd be the same in New Zealand. If you were a couple of wealthy people, you could start buying up an artist, and pay a big price for a piece of art, and suddenly everyone's talking about it. If you know what I mean.
Happened. I doubt if America didn't have great artists, if they did have great artists. I don't think it's true, but on the other hand, you're quite right. For people do manipulate the art, the art market, and that's definitely happened in New Zealand. Absolutely, definitely. I've gone to Westpac banks and I've seen them, a bit of red splashed across black, and it's real poetry or something. It's absolutely nonsense, but it's fetched a princely sum because someone has said, oh, no, he's a great artist. Especially a great Maori artist.
It's sort of like, and you sit there, and that's why I just loved your book, because you just destroy it. And it's so refreshing, Agnes, to have someone just say, he's got no clothes on. Amy, he's got no clothes on.
Well, it's a sad book, actually. It's a depressing book. I had to leave out so much. It's very long. I got told off recently because it's long and it's not much fun to read. But
it's a beautiful read. It's a beautiful. Really. It made me weep. It made me weep. Not in a way that I didn't enjoy reading it, but it was the sense that I assume everyone listening to our show feels that uneasy about the direction of travel this past little while, and what is happening, and what your book does. Is make the whole picture across the whole field and draw it together, and writing with insight and power and beauty, and showing up this dross like modern art. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. I weep for my country. The book didn't cause this. The book didn't cause that, right? But I weep for my country. I wept for what we had and what we just fitted away.
That's true. That's true. And I look at people like Cliff Emeny, that was the name I was looking for, that pilot who was tortured by the Burmese. Not by the Burmese, they tried to save him, by the Japanese. And he got back to New Zealand and said, what's happening? And he was the one who sent me to look at Switzerland, so I want to give him credit for this. And Leo Halleur, they were the two who looked for the binding referendums, actually, and they didn't get the binding part. I think Doug Graham told them at the time, yes, you can have referendums, but I'm sure the government would always take notice of them. The government turned down every single referendum that the people who worked so hard to get 300,000 signatures for, every amount of the government ignored them all. This is a way of claiming back. We've destroyed so much. We've destroyed poetry. It's post-poetry now. Absolute rubbish is getting published, as in the English version of The Spectator. Nobody would bother with it. Why would you? Whereas great poetry, which I'm very fortunate to be involved with teaching some children at the moment. It has so much to say about the human condition. Not only the beauty of the words, but about hope, about despair, about love, about losing things. I remember going up to Nelson College and challenging them because they were not teaching the poetry syllabus. I think I've told you this. And this idiot up there said, oh, it's not appropriate in a specific setting. And I looked at and I said, what about Tennyson? And he said, oh, he's facile. I said, have you any idea of the skill that's needed to make something look so easy? And I think of Tennyson's wonderful poem about dying, you know, sunset and evening star, and may there be no clear call for me. Maybe may there be one clear call for me when I'm called up to see. Tennyson wrote such marvellous poetry, and Robert Browning's Rabbi Ben Ezra, grow old with me, the best is yet to be the last of life, for which the first has come. Poetry taught us so much. If I've mangled anything there, I'm terribly sorry. But Robert Browning, Tennyson, great poets
who appealed
to their sense of beauty.
What about this one? The wind was a torrent of darkness among the gusty trees.
The highwayman.
The moon was a ghostly
galleon. Look for me
galleon.
By moonlight, watch for me by moonlight. Yes. I'll come to thee by moonlight, though hell shall bar the way. Children absolutely love it. And yet, do you know, I was talking to a former intermediate headmaster who was briefly at the school some years ago because the other one had been sacked for embezzling money. And this former headmaster had known my father, and we got talking about great poetry, which was teaching the children. It's out now, of course. It's been phased out. And an inspector came along, and some of the inspectors were very, very fine people, and some of them were absolute fatheads. And this one said, just because you like poetry doesn't mean you've got to inflict it on the children. How about that?
Isn't it? And of course, it's robbing children of the beauty
of their cultural heritage
and of the world.
I know.
How can you? My children got so fascinated by the highwayman, they learned it off by heart. They loved it. They love it.
I know.
I couldn't stop them. They just loved it. And
I know, when I was at school, we were given poetry. The nuns were very good on poetry. And we were given something like Shelley's The Cloud. And we were asked to learn a verse, a stanza. I loved it so much, I learnt the whole thing. Now, a lot of children aren't like that. But some of them will say, oh, they weren't literary minded. Their talents landed the directions. And they would say, oh, I didn't like learning it much at school, other children. But they say, it comes back to me now. It comes back at troubled times. Which it does. We've deprived them of a cultural and an intellectual heritage. And I've got time to tell you one more thing. When I was writing an article for the Christchurch Press on the downgrading of education and various things, and an inspector didn't like this. He wasn't a nice man at all. I knew a bit more about him. And he rang up, and I got an awful lot of support. In fact, at the time, the literary editor said, you've got more letters and support than any subject except the Springbok tour, except from the teachers. And then people said, what teacher does that teach? What school does that teacher teach at? Because my children aren't going there. But anyway, this inspector rang up, and my small son answered the phone. He said, he didn't say anything polite. He said, get your mother. So I came to the phone, and he was going spare because I'd said the importance of teaching spelling. And he said it was completely unfair. This is also Marxist, of course. In those days, they were still talking about the bourgeoisie. And I said, why is it not fair? And he said, it's not fair because some children, he said, if you gave them 10 words a night or a week, some children would have to learn 8 words, and others would only have to learn 2. And my son thought, what an idiot. He said, he wasn't a good speller at all at that stage. He said, what an idiot. He said, I'd be the one that would have to learn 8. And then I'd know those 10 words. Isn't it interesting? Look who's been in charge.
Amy Brooke, will you come back again on the show?
I'd love to talk about education because of the damage that's being done to children in the country.
We will have you back to talk education. Everyone, read Amy's book. Amy Brooke, all one word with an e.co.nz. 100 Days Claiming Back New Zealand, $29.95. It's an extraordinary book. If I was buying it, I'd buy two because you want to give one to someone, but keep yours. We've been talking to
someone sick.
Sorry?
Sorry, I was just saying someone's actually done this. A very nice man, Ray Shaughnessy, has been buying it up and giving it to friends, which is very decent of him.
Very decent of him. We've been talking with Amy Brooke, author, thinker. What else would we say about you? Children's author?
Yes, because my books are blacklisted. That would be really nice.
Beautiful children's books.
In this country.
Crazy, right? Truly an insightful woman, able to look at New Zealand through a lens which allows her to see the decline and fall and then give us hope, because there is a way that we can take our country back from the petty tyrants that rule us and would destroy us. It's wonderful having you on. You're on Radley Check Radio, Real Talk with Rodney High. Please send us a text at 2057. Email me inbox@radleycheck.radio. Please do. And questions for Amy and we'll get her back. I'm sure we can. Thank you for listening.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.